Right, recording is going on a little bit late. I just finished discussing the midterm, so anybody who's listening to the recording missed that scintillating discussion. Let's go on to finance. And as usual, let me start by asking whether you have questions about the first three sections of the chapter that you read on finance. Were there things that didn't make sense to you? Yes? No? Maybe? No. All right. The first essay they start with actually is quite an interesting and, I think, important essay, because it really has to do with the question of why firms exist. That the... Wait, let me turn this off. Figure out how. That the way I put the point is that it's sort of odd to observe that the capitalist beach is made up of socialist grains of sand. That is, if you think about a society like ours, the basic mechanism by which we produce and distribute goods is private property in exchange. All right? But while some of the actors in private property exchange are individuals, many of them are firms, and an individual firm is sort of like a little tiny Stalinist centrally planned economy, right? Now, how much that's going to vary among the firms, but they are sort of your proto-firm, as it were. There's a boss who tells you what to do. That sounds an awful lot like a socialist system. So why do you end up, if the market approach to doing things works well in the large, why do you take it all the way down? And you can. You could certainly imagine a society, what I think somebody referred to as an agoric order, in which, in effect, everybody is a subcontractor. All right? In which, if you want something done, think for a moment about writing books, since that's one of the things I do. And that's when we're moving in that direction due to the Internet. And you can easily enough imagine a system where I write a book. I need help writing a book of the sort that an editor would normally give. And so I pay some individual editor, I email him my manuscript, he sends me back his comments, and I pay him for those comments. When the whole thing is finished, I need a copy editor. Copy editor is the person who goes over your manuscript, not trying to decide whether you're a good writer or said the right things, but do you have punctuation errors, do you have spelling errors, do you have sentences so tangled you can't follow them, sort of very detailed stuff. So I send it off to a copy editor, and in fact, copy editors are, in the present, as things are presently organized, largely freelancers. Copy editing largely is outsourced, in effect. So if I wrote a book for a publisher right now, very likely the copy editor would be somewhere other than the publishing firm, would not be on salary, would be getting some payment per page or something. So I send it off to the copy editor. Well, I've done that. Now what do I do? Well, I could go to somebody who's got a copying machine or an offset press or something and say, look, here is my text on a flash disk. Make me 500 copies of this book and contract with him to make me 500 copies of the book. I then go to somebody else who's in the business of selling books and I say, look, I'd like to sell you some copies of the book at this price, and you can then go find customers and sell it to them. And some of that really happens, as it happens. My current publishing project is a print-on-demand, self-publishing one using CreateSpace, which is an Amazon subsidiary, and hopefully I'm going to have that done within another few weeks. And one of the things I've done is to correspond with somebody who I happen to know sells the kind of book that this is, and ask her how much of a discount she needs to make it worth her handling the book. So you get a good deal of that. On the other hand, if you think about how most publishing is done, the editor is not being paid by me. The editor is being paid by my publisher, which is a firm which has got a bunch of employees. And the editor, not the copy editor, but the ordinary editor, is somebody who is on salary, whose job includes reading manuscripts and deciding which ones to publish, then giving advice to the author about his book and so forth and so on. And similarly, if you think about the law school, you could certainly imagine a form of legal education in which there were no firms, in which there were no schools, in which what happens is that you want to learn something that I can teach, and so you contract with me, and, you know, I've got a room in my house, say, which is a classroom, and certain people come there, and I teach them something, and now they say, ah, but we want to be able to prove to potential employers we've learned, and they say, oh, yeah, well, Mr. Smith down the road, he runs an examination firm.
one-man examination firm, and he will give you exams, and he will rate you on those exams and report those to, and so forth. And in that system, you don't have dormitories. People just rent, you know, rooms and apartments and hotels. And of course, a lot of people, especially beyond the undergraduate level, I guess, I don't think we have any dorms for law students, do we? I don't think they usually don't. So you can imagine universities or publishers being decentralized down to the point where there were no employees at all. And the question is, why isn't that the norm? Why is what you actually get is a mix of that, of my freelance copy editor type, or the author, for example. I'm not an employee of my publisher, all right? I'm in an agoric relationship with the publisher. Mix of that and of enterprises that have, you know, anything from a few to hundreds of thousands, I guess, for a really big firm of employees. And that's what Kosa's article on the nature of the firm is really about. And the argument is that there are both advantages and disadvantages to the contracting model. There's a pretty good book by someone else that's really on this subject. It's called Market and Hierarchy, discussing the advantages of those two ways of coordinating. And one of the stories he tells, or I didn't know before I read that, is about what was called the inside contracting system, which was a way in which things were made in the 19th century, which was much closer to the agoric system than what we have. And the example which I think he offers is you're making rifles. So you have one building, and several different firms, each of which is renting space in that building. And one of the firms makes a stock for a rifle. And another firm makes the rifle barrel for a rifle. And another one makes the receiver, the part that actually, you know, has got the action and where the bullet goes off in and so forth, for one. Maybe another one makes the sights. And then a fifth one is in the business of assembly. And they buy from the other four their output, put it all together into a rifle, and go sell it. Or maybe they wholesale it, somebody is selling it. And that has some real advantages. The advantage is that at each level, the people who are assembling it don't have to worry about how hard the people at the other levels are working, because they're not paying them by the hour, they're paying them by the rifle barrel or stock or whatever. On the other hand, there are also problems. That in that situation, if one of those five firms has a problem, if, you know, the boss decides that he's going to, you know, run away with his girlfriend and leave his wife and go off to Hawaii or something, everybody else shuts down because they don't have the inputs they need. And you can think of a variety of other problems of that sort. And so the point that was being made was that while there are real advantages to the market system in which each person, as it were, is fully responsible for what he's doing, there are also costs because what he is doing can affect the other people, and therefore there are some advantages to the alternative system in which somebody at one level is hiring everybody else, giving them orders of what to do. They can quit. There are limits to what they've agreed they'll do for him, how many hours they'll work, whether or not they'll murder people or whatever, but within wide limits, he gets to decide. And that in a market society, you've got, as it were, a continual competition between these two approaches, and if it turns out the firms are getting too big and that the disadvantages, because the disadvantage of hierarchy is, you know, the more levels there are between the president and the factory floor, First, the more people you've got to have watching other people, or watching other people to make sure someone down there is getting work done, and the worse your control is. So that's the cost. And the advantage is that you avoid the kinds of problems that I was discussing with markets. Of course, another problem with markets is what if your supplier realizes that you're in real trouble, he stops supplying, so he suddenly raises his price. So you then start getting into long-term contracting and other things of that sort. And if you have enough long-term contracting, it starts looking a lot like a firm. Right. So in any case, that's really a it was, I think, a seminal article by Coase. There's, I think, another one by Demsetz that covered some of the same stuff. And there are some things, if you have sort of a good where what you're selling is well-defined, there are lots of people selling it, mowing lawns or something, it makes a good deal of sense to do it with one-man firms, and if I don't like what you're doing, I'll go hire somebody else. But it gets a lot harder when I care not only about what you do today, but tomorrow and next week and the week after. You're a salesman and you've got relations with customers, and I don't want you taking those customers away, and so forth. So one solution is contracts, but another solution is the particular set of contracts that we think of as a firm. So that's the basic point. And you then, you know, if you read stories about outsourcing and about merging firms and about firms divesting them, in a sense, what that all of that stuff is largely about is this question of sort of optimal size of the firm. Merging, if you imagine that we've got two firms where they can coordinate better via hierarchy. If they're one firm, then they could coordinate via the market as multiple firms. And divesting the other direction when you say, oops, we could do just as well without it. But and a lot of people tend to have this idea that sort of bigger is always better. Then you say, but wait a minute, why doesn't GM have a glass factory? Why don't they have a tire factory? And the answer is that those are things where it apparently turns out that they can produce cars cheaper if somebody else produces glass and they just buy it from them. Someone else produces tires and they just buy it from them than if they were doing it all themselves. So any questions on that part of the discussion, which is sort of trying to understand why firms exist in the first place? All right. One of the things that's wrong in the book is their claim that Burrell and Means were the people who originally spotted the problem with the joint stock corporation, and thus that it was significant that this problem was first spotted in the 1930s, because it wasn't first spotted in the 1930s. It was spotted at least as early as the late 18th century, because Adam Smith has the Burrell and Means argument in The Wealth of Nations. That Adam Smith is discussing joint stock companies, which were quite uncommon at the time, and he points out that the problem with it, you people understand what I mean by joint stock companies, what sort of most modern corporations are. It's a company where there are lots of stockholders, and the stockholders aren't the people who are actually running the company, though the people who run the company may own some stock, but you basically have a division between the investors who provide the capital, who are the stockholders, and who are the ultimate authority in that they can vote to change the board of directors, which can fire the CEO, but the actual running is being done by employees from the CEO all the way down. And Adam Smith said, well, you know, the problem with the system is everybody's business is nobody's business. That the people who are running the firm can pay themselves high salaries, have luxurious offices, you know, not work very hard, do whatever they like. Each individual stockholder will correctly realize that for the amount of stock he has, it isn't worth his making an almost full-time profession out of watching how the firm is being run and forming an opinion. And therefore, Smith argued, this form of organization can only work if two conditions are met. One of them is you have an enterprise that needs very large amounts of capital so that an individual, even a wealthy individual entrepreneur, can't do it by himself. And the other is that what the enterprise is doing is sufficiently simple that it isn't very hard to see if they're doing a good job. And the example he offered was insurance companies. That he thought, at least in the late 18th century, that was one of the few places where you could expect a joint stock company to survive. So it's Burrell and Means are famous for, you know, bringing it into the modern literature, but in fact it was a very old idea by the time they had it. But then, of course, the interesting question is, why was Adam Smith wrong? All right, that Smith, having proved that joint stock corporations could only be run under these very narrow circumstances, we then have the question of how Apple exists, how Microsoft exists. They're doing very complicated things where it's very hard to figure out if they're doing a good job, where the money they're spending today is getting returns for the next 10 or 15 years, and how can a stockholder know if it's the right decision? And, of course, there are joint stock companies, quite a lot of joint stock companies, in areas where they're also competing with sole proprietorships. That, you know, every time a company is taken private, it's just switched away from that. So again, it can't be that they exist only in places where even a wealthy person doesn't have enough money to run. Can anybody suggest what Smith might have missed? What mechanisms that he does not consider do we have for, as it were, disciplining the people, controlling the people who are running joint stock? Anybody? What?
Fiduciary obligation.
Yeah, I don't know if he discusses that. Do you really think that that has much effect? That after all, the normal legal rule is business judgment rule, which means that while they can't literally take the, they can't have the company buy a house for me and just give it to me over a wide range of stuff. Yeah.
Sure, takeover.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing that he misses, the potential for takeover bit. That it's true it does not pay the individual stockholder. But suppose I am somebody who either has a lot of money or has access to a lot of money, who's got a reputation that lets me borrow a lot of money, and I'm really good at telling if companies are well run or not. All right, well, there's the potential for me to search for a badly run company and start buying stock in. And in the simple case, I buy up 51% of the stock, at least. I then call a stockholder meeting. I then replace the board of directors with people who I trust. They then replace the administrative people they trust. And what happens in a year or two or three, the market observes that the company's doing much better than it used to be, and the stock shoots up. And I own 51% of that stock, and I've just made myself $3 billion, which is going to be very useful when I want to do another thing for a bit. All right? And go.
What about hiring out the job of monitoring managers? So, like, the shareholders from multiple companies cumulatively pay someone, maybe a government, to watch over the managers of all the companies.
And then the problem is, how do you arrange to make it in the interest of the people who they hired to do it, to actually do it? How do you arrange, given that each of the individual stockholders has the same disincentive to monitor their monitors as to monitor the company, whereas the company has obvious ways of making it attractive to the monitoring people to say good things about them? How do you set up that mechanism? You'll notice that
I don't know. I don't have a good answer, but one possibility is that it's much easier to tell whether the monitor of monitors is doing a good job than the actual managers. It's very easy to tell whether the monitors, the third party monitors that you hired.
How? If the company goes bust, how do you know if it's because the monitor should have seen it and didn't tell you, or if what's going on is that the company was engaged in a risky activity and they could have made a fortune or they could have gone bust, and, you know, once in a while. I'm not saying that's impossible, because this is like the Consumer Reports problem, of course. If you think about how you handle this problem for consumer goods, and of course it's also the problem of democracy. That is, the argument for why corporations can't work is an even stronger argument for why democratic government can't work, because the number of voters is much larger than the number of stockholders, and you don't have a takeover bid option. You can't transfer your vote and your share, as it were. And in fact, there was somebody I knew of who wrote something somewhere arguing the solution to democracy was to make takeover bids possible. So what he wanted to do was to have citizenships be marketable. So you own a U.S. citizenship, and you can sell it. And you can even sell it to somebody who agrees to lease it back to you for a fixed price for some number of years. But when he's got it, he has the vote. And he's the ultimate owner. So his idea is you then have a takeover bid on a country where somebody accumulates enough citizenship so that he can vote out the existing administration, vote in somebody competent. After a year or so, everybody in the world says, isn't this a wonderfully run country? I'd like a citizenship. Well, that's just fine, but the prices have gone up a little bit now that it's such a well-run country. So it's sort of a cute idea for whether you could apply that. But the basic is that there may be other factors as well, but it seems to me that one of the important things that Smith missed was that even though most of the time everybody's business is nobody's business, because the share of stock is transferable, there is the possibility for somebody to make himself into someone who has a large share of the company, and that when he does that, it then is in his interest to monitor the company and try to control it. Of course, in the world that now exists, the effect of regulation is not to make that easier, to make that harder. Because under current law, if you are accumulating stock in a company beyond some particular, I think it's 10%, but I'm not sure, you must publicly announce the fact. And obviously, one of the weaknesses in this strategy, especially the second time you do it, is that if people know you're good at spotting such companies and reforming them, then once they know you're accumulating the stock, the stock price is going to go up and you're not going to be able to make as much money because you'll be buying at a price that already reflects people's estimate of what you're going to do.
So that's one respect in which existing securities regulation makes it harder for judicial administrators on these here. But anyway, the basic point I was making really is that Bernal and Means are pointing out a very real problem, and it's a problem which was recognized long before them, but it is a problem which has at least one solution that I've never read their books, so I don't know if they discuss it somewhere, but at least I don't think the excerpt we had discussed it, and that Smith, as far as I can tell, did not think about it as a possible solution. Now note that in the modern world, one way of doing it is not by having a lot of money, but only by being able to borrow a lot of money. That's what so-called junk bonds were. It's basically, if you're somebody who's got the reputation of being good at taking over firms and making them run better, you maybe even taking them private, making them no longer joint stock, you can, in effect, issue a lot of bonds whose value is from people's belief that you're going to make this company do well and therefore be able to pay off the bonds, use that money to buy up lots of stock, and then take them over the company. And you will be called all sorts of names by the existing management, people who are on their side for obvious reasons, but on the other hand, you're bidding the stock price up, not down, by trying to buy it. Notice that there's another problem associated with joint stock company situation, and that's the problem of conflicts among stockholders. So that you could certainly, if you think about it, I put it in terms of 51%, but of course you don't really need 51% to take over a company because at most stockholder meetings, most stockholders don't show up, and their stocks, so they may give a proxy, but they don't, I ever give a proxy for my vote because I say to myself, why should I spend hours figuring out which group that wants my proxy are going to make the company run better in order that my $200 worth of this company can be worth $210. That's a pretty low per hour wage for me to do it, especially since my giving them the proxy doesn't mean that they'll win. It just means that they're, you know, a thousandth more likely to win. So it's a very, very small payoff. Exactly the same problem as rational ignorance in voting. Why should you figure out whether one candidate or another is better when you know that your vote has only a very, very small chance of affecting? Yeah. Simple problem. So one problem in potentially is suppose we've got two groups of stockholders. One of them consists of three people who between them own 20% of the stock, and the other consists of 100,000 who own the rest. You then have to worry that the people with the large holdings, even though it's a small minority in total, they're going to show up at the stockholder meeting, they're going to get their people on the board of directors, and maybe, depending on how it's done, they can get the board of directors to, in effect, benefit them at the cost of the other stockholders. So you could imagine easily enough a case where, in addition to owning 10% of the stock of Company A, I also am the sole proprietor of Company B. Company A has dealings with Company B, and their dealings on terms very favorable to Company B because my board of directors arranged that way. So one of the things that presumably corporate law tries to control, how successfully I'm not sure, is the degree of sort of the theory is that all decisions have to treat all stockholders equally, and the problem is to an extent to what they can do so. What is the relevance of all of this stuff to legal issues? And one of them is the question of whether firms merging produces benefits. And that's in particular relevant to antitrust law, because in antitrust law, mergers are somewhat suspect because people are worried about merger and monopoly. And therefore the question of, is it plausible that this merger is being made not to get a monopoly, but because the two firms can produce better together than apart, is a legitimate issue in antitrust here. One of my friends had an ingenious proposal for how the antitrust division ought to decide what mergers to allow. And it's very simple. When two firms want to merge, see what the opinions of the other firm in the industry are. If the other firms in the industry are against the merger, what decision should the antitrust division make? If the other firms are for the merger, what decision should they make?
purpose of the merger is to form a very large firm which will reduce output and drive up prices. That's the first one. Or the purpose of the merger is to produce a larger firm which will produce at lower cost or higher quality and will therefore drive down prices. Which of those two do the competitors prefer?
The first.
That's right. So his argument was, if the competitors tell you don't allow the merger, allow it. And if they tell you allow it, then block it. Which, of course, only works until the competitors figure out what you're doing. But still, I thought it was sort of a clever one. I think that was, I'm not positive, I think that was the same friend. I think it was Ami Glazer, who was also the person who, have I told you about Ami's scheme for buying a used car? Did I tell you that story where you basically you ask the sellers if they're willing to give a guarantee, and when you find one willing to give a guarantee, you then buy the car without the guarantee? This is a sort of spirit. Clever guy. I haven't seen him for many years. Why do you see your mind? So one argument is antitrust. Another argument is then with the stockholders, that the stockholders, when they see the merger, would like to know, is it plausible that it's going to benefit us, or is it that the CEO would like to be CEO of a bigger firm, and they will have more status, be more important, be invited to better parties, so forth and so on, and therefore he's empire building. And the stockholders would like to be able to make a guess as to which way they ought to vote insofar as they vote on. And finally, if you imagine an honest CEO that's just trying to serve the stockholders, the Kosian arguments will help tell him when you ought to be looking for merger targets and when you ought not to. And it applies not only to merging, but also to divesting. So if you think about a stock, about a CEO who says, you know, we've got this quite profitable division, somebody would like to buy it from us. Or somebody would like to buy just the division and take it private or something. Well, an obvious question is it more profitable to us than it would be by itself? And if there aren't any advantages, if the kind of the Kosian kind of arguments don't tell us, imagine the case where the division has nothing to do with what we're doing. Maybe it has to do with what we were doing 20 years ago. We moved out of that field. Then there's a pretty strong argument for divesting on the grounds that it can run itself better as a small firm than as a division of a large firm. On the other hand, it is still making some input to what we're doing, where there would be problems with buying the input on the market, then it would make it make sense not to. So managerial discretion is one of the issues that law deals with, and it's the usual rules of the business judgment rule. And on the one hand, the reason the firm exists in a certain sense is managerial discretion, the idea that the manager is in a better position to tell you what to do than if you just have to do it all out on the market. But on the other hand, you want to worry about the fact that the borough needs problem, one of their problems, which is the managers can benefit themselves at the expense of the stockholders. I don't know if I've recommended to you before seeing Northcott Parkinson, who's a British author, by no longer alive, who was very good at writing humorous essays that made serious points. And I remember one of his essays where he's got two employees of the company were talking. Someone has come to the company and said, look, I've got this worthy cause. Can you give some money for it? And the guy says, you know, first employee says, well, you know, what did you tell him? And said, oh, I told him that I would try to persuade my superiors that we ought to endorse his cause. What did you do? He said, I gave him £20 and told him to go to hell. The distinction between spending your own money and willing to spend other people's money. And one of the things one might want to think about is whether a firm that makes a point of being socially responsible, which is rather more likely to be subsidizing opera than subsidizing poor people's food, ought to be seen as good or bad. And from the standpoint of the stockholder, obviously if you're an opera lover, you're going to be happy that they're doing that. But if you're a stockholder and your firm tells you in glowing terms all the good it's done, you know, helped with an art museum and helped with education for poor kids in the neighborhood and then this and that, what guesses might you make as to why they're doing it? Good or bad? Because I think they're in fact guesses in both directions. Yep.
They're trying to create PR to lay over some potentially hazardous PR.
I think that's too narrow. It wouldn't have to be hazardous. But more generally, they're trying to get a good reputation on the grounds that if people sort of smile when they see the name of the firm, they'll be more willing to buy from them, more willing to work for them, and so on. And I think that's a real element. It's a technology you understand very well. But if you think about sort of happy firms, that there are stores I go to, and it's just pretty clear that the people working there are nice people who like each other. And it's sort of, you know, if you ever want to buy any level, I can recommend it's a fine company out in San Jose, of which that's certainly the impression I always get when I go there, and there are other places in which that's true. So you would certainly think about, well, our employees are going to feel happy because they know we're doing good things. So that's one possibility. Can you think of another possibility?
Yep.
You
mean
force
the government?
That's one, although in that case, they may or may not be able to persuasively put it in there. Let me tell you a true story, not about corporate donations, but it's still relevant. This is from a book by Eric Posner, Judge Posner's son, on norms. And somebody took a look at opera donations. And it turns out that opera programs have a list on the back of donors. And the list is generally something like donations of under $200. Donations between $200 and $500. Between $500 and $1,000, that kind of thing. If you look at the amounts people donate, what do you think they tend to, where do they cluster? And imagine we've got, we have an opera thing, and it has one list which says $100 donations of at least $100. Another is donations of at least $500, and another is donations of at least $1,000. What do you think the actual sums are? Yeah?
My guess would be at the bottom and at the top.
Why at the top? Why would anybody donate $999?
The people who donate at the highest level, I'm sorry, the highest level, will attract all the people who are trying to accumulate PR.
But to do that, what you want to do is to donate 1,001.
Right. So
you get the same PR for 1,001 as for 2,000. You get the same PR for 501 as you do for 900.
So whatever the highest level is, my guess is that.
My point is not which category they're going to be in, but where are they in the category? And the answer empirically is that they're in the very bottom, just above the cutoff. Because that buys them the same reputational effect. These don't have to be firms. These can just be individuals who want to be thought to be patrons of opera, or the arts, or whatever. So the point that Posner would make is they're buying status, essentially. Well, but if that's right, then you can also see, go back to the Parkinson story, that if I'm the CEO of a firm, and I'd like to be thought of by other high-status people as, you know, a good, generous, important person. Well, how do I do it? My firm gives $50,000 for the opera. That's the cost of being money. So the flip side is one argument for why you would do these things is in order that various people inside and outside the firm will be happy with you and will think well of you. And the other is, in order that various people will think well of the CEO, the person who's making the decision, my guess is that if you have gotten your company to donate $50,000 to the opera, you'll get a good seat. And if you want to talk to the opera stars after the show, they'll be happy to talk to you. And I'm pretty sure, just sort of watching the world around me, that if you donate a bunch of money to Santa Clara University, that you will get treated nicely as a result. I don't swear because I'm not involved in this, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised if donating money to the law school gets you an inside track on being told which students are really good. Maybe not. Maybe we don't work it that way. But that's the general rule, sort of part of the way the world goes, is that people trade favors, as it were. And if you can have a favor that's being paid for your stockholders, not by you, it's a very attractive concept. So those are both possible possibilities, and that's then it seems to me, something you want to think about if you're a stockholder in terms of whether you say yay or wait a minute, he's buying his status with my money about people doing what he thinks. And as I said, one of the notable points is I think that quite often the generous publicly benefited donations are donations for the consumption of the upper classes. I'm thinking of operating equivalent. And not that everybody who has opera is rich, but on the whole, if you want people to feel grateful to you, you aren't going to get people in the slums to feel grateful to you by giving money to opera. But you might by, I don't know what relevant things are, by giving money to a, you know, a child care clinic or something like that. But on the other hand, if you're a high-status person, most of the people you're dealing with are high-status people, and they are much more likely to go to opera than to send their kids to a free child care clinic. Anyway, I may be wrong, but it seems to me that that's one of the things you want to think about.
All right, let me go on to talk about the Miller Modigliani piece and the more general issue of sort of how you do science. And that is that it is very often useful to set up a problem with simplifying assumptions in such a way that you can see the basic logic of the problem while avoiding a lot of complications. And my favorite example of this is one of the most important figures in the history of economics, a man called David Ricardo, who was really the first great economic theorist. And what he did was what a modern economist would call general equilibrium theory, where most of economics is partial equilibrium and that you're thinking of the rest of the world as the same and what happens if you change this a little bit of it and only look at the direct effects. Whereas general equilibrium theory, you have to say, wait a minute, if I cut the price of my widgets and people buy more widgets, if they buy more than proportionally more widgets, they have less money to spend on other things, so that's going to affect all the other things, and so forth and so on. Much harder problem. And Ricardo was, I think, the first person ever to actually think through that problem and solve it. And any modern economist could tell you that you can't solve that problem with without a lot of advanced mathematics. At least calculus would probably know it. Well, we like calculus. Ricardo uses nothing beyond arithmetic. How does he do it? He makes a set of simplifying assumptions, which reduce the complications, essentially assume away the complications while keeping the guts of the problem. And the way I described it somewhere in one of my books was that the modern economist reading Ricardo's principles feels as if he was a member of the first Mount Everest expedition. And as he approached the summit, a hiker came down the slope wearing t-shirt and tennis shoes. Very impressive piece of work, but it's very tricky because sometimes your simplifying assumptions are what generate your result rather than what you find the result, if that makes any sense. And I've certainly seen work where if you look at it carefully, you realize that what they claim to be the, you know, important result of their analysis is really an artifact of the simplifying assumptions. It would go away without those assumptions. Not just it wouldn't be as predictable, or it wouldn't be as solid, or it wouldn't be there at all. So again, if you look at Coase, one step of Coase's, not the theory of the firm, but it's an even more famous article, Problem of Social Cost, part of that analysis is to say, suppose you have a world with no transaction costs, meaning a world where any time that there are two people, there's some bargain they can make that will benefit both of them and gets made. And he then analyzed certain economic problems in that world and pointed out that in that world, certain well-understood problems didn't exist. And the implication of that is that those well-understood problems are problems that, in a certain sense, come not from what people thought was the source of them, but from the transaction costs that prevent people from solving them via private transactions. And that's a problem of social cost. But that's another example. Miller Modigliani, I don't know as well, but pretty clearly one of the things they're doing is working in a world of perfect information. Well, world of perfect information doesn't describe the world, but features that exist in the real world that don't exist in their world presumably are associated with information costs. That's a useful thing to know. So it's in general sort of a strategy. Just as when you're teaching basic physics, you often do it in a world without friction, because it's a whole lot easier to work out what things you're going to do in a world without friction. Having solved that problem, you can then go on to the more complicated problems and figure out at least approximate ways of doing them. So, if you're curious about the Coase case, my book Law's Order is on my webpage, and you can find several chapters on that, and I also have an article which I think is called called either The Swedes Got It Right or The World According to Coase, because they did two different versions of it. It's on my webpage. The Swedes, because they gave him a Nobel Prize, and it's an explanation of why he deserved it. But anyway, sort of a digression. Miller and Modigliani were asking the question, how is what happens to a firm affected by how much of its financing is equity and how much is debt? And what they apparently showed, and I haven't read their work myself, was that in a perfect information world, it didn't matter that the firm did equally well with any ratio of the two. And I gather from the summary in the book that that's partly because as you lower the equity and raise the debt, you also raise the variation, the uncertainty, because you're highly leveraged. And now if your company does well, you make a fortune. Does badly, you go broke. And that's going to affect the value of that company to stockholders, and presumably also it's going to affect how much you have to pay for your debt, because if there's too much risk, people may be afraid you won't be able to pay them. And questions? No. All right. They then went on to give you the Jensen and Meckling piece, which was really pointing out that the conflict between the stockholders and the managers is really just a special case of agency theory, of the fact that you've got someone you want to act as your agent, you want him to act in your interest, he's going to act in his interest. How do you make the two as nearly the same as possible? And as they, I think, correctly point out, there are then three different costs associated with the agency problem. One of them is the cost to the principal of monitoring the agent, of whatever time and effort I spend trying to make sure you're doing what I want. One is the cost to the agent of monitoring the agent. That's not the way they put it, but the cost to the agent of whatever things he does in order to give the principal reason to trust him. So let me take a very simple example of that, which is think about whether the CEO of a company ought to own stock in the company. What's the argument for and what's the argument against? Yeah?
That he owns stock in the company, a lot of stock in the company, and he's more inclined to do things that are interesting.
What's the argument against?
The argument against.
Why, if you were the CEO, might you be disinclined to put most of your wealth into stock in the company? Yeah? What?
I have thought. That
what?
Was,
thought yep.
Because you still have to manage everybody else?
Well, you have to do that anyway. But the question is, let's put it differently. You have two alternatives. You're the CEO of Apple. And you have two alternatives. One of them is to put most of your wealth into Apple, and the other is to put some of your wealth into GM and some of your wealth into Exxon, and to spread your wealth among a bunch of firms having nothing to do with the computer industry. What is the argument for the second strategy from your standpoint?
Why use your own money?
What?
Why put your own money in a company
when
you can use it?
Why not? Why isn't your company as good a place to invest anywhere else? Yeah?
It's just putting a lot of risk.
That's right, because if either your company or the industry does badly, you're out of a job. Right? And you've lost all your money. So if you want to diversify, you have an incentive not to hold stock in your own company. All right. So you could think of holding stock in your own company, and in particular, doing it in believable ways, making it clear you haven't, meanwhile, sold through a third party futures in that stock. You haven't there are lots of ways you can hedge. Right? People know what hedging means? Transactions in which you get rid of risk. So, simple example. Let's suppose that I am a baking company, and in order to do my business, I need to have $10 million worth of flour in my warehouse. Say, well, this is a problem, because if the price of flour goes down, and the price, of course, of the bread goes down, I'm going to lose a lot of money. If it goes up, I'll be well off, of course. I don't like that risk. Well, one way is to go out into the market and sell flour futures. I think selling futures, you're right. That's to make a bet such that the situation that will hurt you because of your inventory of flour will help you because of your investment, and vice versa. In this case, it's called hedging. And similarly, you could imagine the CEO says, yeah, I got $5 million worth of stock in the firm, and he's telling the stockholders that he's also, in effect, sold $5 million in some less visible fashion somewhere else. But assuming he can constrain himself to hold a lot of his personal wealth of stock in the firm, that's a cost to him because he's not risk-spreading. But it's a way of assuring the stockholders that he can be trusted because his interest is closer to their interest. So you could think of that as what's being referred to as bonding in the discussion from Jensen and Meckling. That's what they're referring to as bonding. Anything that the agent does, costly to him, designed to provide the principal reasons to trust him, essentially. And if it costs me $10,000 but makes me worth $20,000 more to the principal by making my interest more nearly aligned with his, it's worth doing. And their point is that if you think about an agency situation, one cost is the cost of the principal monitoring the agent. One cost is the cost to the agent of doing things that amount to monitoring, of doing things that convince the principal needs to be trusted. And the third cost is whatever divergence between their interests still remains when he's done that. All right, so if you imagine the case where, going back to my earlier case, the CEO gives $5 million to the opera. And in fact, $1 million to the opera would have been in the interest of his stockholders, because up to that point, the good PR for his firm is worth it. But the next $4 million cost his stockholders $4 million, gave him $1 million worth of status feeling, gave the firm $1 million worth of extra PR, but very expensive PR, net cost of $2 million. Does that make sense what I'm saying? That is, let me run through that example. So I just made it up again. Imagine that the CEO is donates of the company's money, not his money, $5 million to opera. And let's see, is there another? I'm running out of these things, and this one is dying. I should make a point of bringing some contributing to it. No. Anyway, so let's suppose that the first $1 million was worth its cost as PR to the firm. All right? The next $4 million produces two kinds of benefit. It produces a benefit to the firm, but not a $4 million benefit. It gets them the good PR, but we'll think of that as $1 million to the firm. Plus another $1 million of status to the CEO. If he'd be willing to pay $1 million of his own money to get the opportunity to go backstage in the opera and to be thought of as a generous person and all the rest of it. Well, cost $4 million. Now, the $1 million of status, you might argue, only goes to the stockholders because they get CEOs cheaper if the CEOs get status by being CEOs. But it's worth at most $1 million a year, net cost of $2 million. All right? So if the mechanisms by which the stockholders make sure that CEO behaves himself aren't good enough to stop that, then in addition to the cost of the stockholders of their time watching the CEO, and in addition to the cost of the CEO of being under-diversified because he owns stock in the company, there's another $2 million cost, because even with all that they're doing, there's a divergence of interest between stockholders and the CEO. Make sense? So I'm just sort of really repeating what the quote says, except that it seemed to me that if I wasn't familiar with this stuff, it might not have made sense to me, and I therefore ought to run through it again. And in the case of the privately owned firm, no problem. He's both making decisions and taking all of the benefits. But in that case, of course, benefits are non-pecuniary as well as pecuniary. It's not that he's maximizing his profit. He's maximizing profit in dollars plus profit than anything else that matters to him. And anything else that matters to him might be being seen as an important figure on the local social scene. It might be having his employees smile at him when he comes in. It might be not working too hard. It might he's working very hard, depending on the particular. But the if you imagine somebody who owns his own firm, he's going to collect both the non-monetary and the monetary benefits, and it's in his interest to maximize all of them. If he owns half the firm, just like somebody who's insured his factory against fire for 50%, now his incentive to trade off those two is different, and now, if he's not monitored, he's going to say, well, if I can get a dollar of non-pecuniary benefit and anything less than $2 cost in money, I should do it. All right, so that's going to be an inefficiency, so that's the disadvantage, and it becomes more and more of a problem the greater the share of the ownership is not in his hands. All right. So that means that there is a real advantage to the firm that is run by its owner. All right. The next chunk of it is sort of what I think of as very standard economics, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, which is the question of how you evaluate payments over time. All right. And the one point which I thought I would probably make in our last couple of minutes, because I don't think they make it clearly enough, is that there are two different things that people confuse. And one of them is the interest rate and one of them is inflation. So that when I say, what's the value of dollars today in terms of dollars next year? There are two different questions I might be answering. One of them is what this year goods can my dollars this year buy compared to next year goods my dollar next year can buy? That's inflation. Imagine we have a society where there is no inflation, where average prices or maybe all prices are staying the same year after year, which may seem exotic to you, but it was the state of the world for long periods of time. U.S., I think through most of the 19th century, as I remember, the U.S. had pretty stable prices. Drops at the end of the century and some ups and downs. But in that world, you still have a positive interest rate. So there is a different sense of just say, what's the exchange rate between a dollar now and a dollar next year? Well, if I have a dollar now, I can put it in the bank and it'll give me $1.05 next year. So in that sense, this year dollars trade for 5% more next year dollars, which means that this year goods trade for 5% more next year goods. So if you're willing to give up some consumption now, you can in exchange have a little more consumption next year. All right? All of the stuff they're talking about is in those terms. Now, what's true is that if you have inflation, that will tend to result in the interest rate being higher, because the interest rate has to compensate you both for postponing your consumption and for the fact that a dollar won't buy as much next year. So the standard economic rule is that what's called the nominal interest rate, which is what you actually see as the official interest rate or what the bank charges you, is the sum of the inflation rate and the real interest rate. And the real interest rate is the interest rate in goods, not in money. It is how many things this year could you trade for things next year, same things. All right, I think that covers what I wanted to say, and we will go on. And on Wednesday, we can talk about that stuff and whatever else we've gotten to in the reading by then. Midterms are there if anybody didn't pick them up. Thank you.